4-3-2-1.
I call a meeting to order of the Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee and the Subcommittee on Early Childhood for the Summit and the Early Childhood Caucus. So first of all, I want to say welcome to everyone for coming today into this wonderful facility. I have to admit, I have not been in this part of town, and I should be here a lot more because I think the services that are going on here that we're going to hear about and what the legislature should be doing all ties into us getting out and getting on the road and seeing what's happening in early childhood. I'm just going to do a brief introduction on Nora Slawick, and I chair the Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee in the House. And I will just go over the agenda a little bit, and then I'm going to turn it over to Senator Bonhoff, and then members are going to have you introduce yourselves, and then we'll start with the commissioner for her testimony. How this meeting came together was a couple of months ago. The Senate Education Policy Committee, chaired by Senator Wieger, appointed a subcommittee on early childhood. And the Senate subcommittee chairs, Senator Bonhoff and Senator Michelle, approached me about doing joint hearings. And that's a very exciting thing if you've worked around the Capitol very much. We don't do a lot together. So it's very exciting for us to be here with the senators, to be talking together, to be trying to get on the same page in terms of policy and how we can move the state forward. So that's the gist of how we got started. There will be three hearings. The first will be 0-3, which is this hearing, so we're hoping to focus on, of course, the youngest children and how to get off on the right start. The next hearing will be in Robbinsdale in Senator Bonhoff's district at the Winnetka Community Center on, is it November 13th, right, in Robbinsdale. So you'll be getting more information about that, same time, 10 to 12. And then we are also, I'm sure it's Senator Michelle's birthday, we'll have to be successful for that. And then December 11th, we will have the partnerships between early childhood and school age or school programs. And that's being set, we're looking at either sort of northern Minnesota, maybe the Hermantown area, or southern Minnesota. So there's a couple of big choices out there, but we're looking for the right combination of partnerships and how to get started. With that, I'm going to ask the members to introduce themselves. I'll start with Senator Bonhoff. If you could say your name, your district, and then we always try to do something early childhood related here with this committee. If you could say where you lived, we've done this once before our committee, where you lived when you were 3 years old. Okay, so Nora Slawick, Oakdale, and Maplewood, and I live in Tucson, Arizona, which I am a native of, and was born, raised there, and went to college there. And came up here.
Well, thank you, and I too, as co-chair with Senator Michelle of the Early Childhood Subcommittee, welcome you here, and we're so glad to begin the process of having these hearings. And the reason why, besides that they do such a great job in their Early Childhood Committee in the House, the reason why we asked the House members to join us in this effort is we felt like we didn't get as much done in the last legislative session as we could have had we worked together earlier. And we didn't want to have that same problem this session, so we said, let's begin right now. Let's start talking. And so you may see as we do this hearing that we're going to do it a little bit differently than hearings in the past. We're going to actually take the time in the middle of hearing. We may stop the testifiers and say, well, members, what do you think about that? And just talk about it. And we may not agree. You may hear us disagree. And that is the most important thing, because at the end of the day, there's not going to be any policy unless we all can come to some consensus. So we'd like to do this in the public, and we've invited our Early Childhood Caucus members who are representatives and senators but who aren't part of this committee to be in the audience here so that they can also be active members in this conversation. So if you're an elected senator or representative but you're not at the table, can you just raise your hand so we recognize you? There, Representative Mullery, thank you so much. Well, we did issue the invitation, I'll tell you. And pretty soon I will turn it over to Senator Michelle, but I just want to say one more thing, and that is I had the occasion to go on a tour of the North Side with the Peace Foundation, with young people from the Peace Foundation a few weeks ago, and they took a few other of us legislators around the North Side, and the young people shared with us some of the tremendous problems they face in this community, and they shared with us how they had lost their brother who was shot, or their best friend, and as they were telling us these stories, they started to cry, and we were on this bus, and Senator Rust and Senator Higgins, we were all crying listening to these stories. And I left that tour thinking, you know, what can we do? And then I thought, of course, you know, the most important thing we can do is early childhood education. We have to reach these young people early to leave them with a sense of hope. And that's why we're here, is to give our young people a new beginning and a sense of hope. And I know that's why we're all here. So thank you. And I, at 3 years old, sorry to go on like that, but just having tours in Northside, I really had to say something about the wonderful work they're doing here. At age 3, I lived in Edina.
Well, that's a good place to live. All right. Well, Senator Bonoff's preparing for filibusters.
I'm not.
I'm sorry, Chair. I'm Jeff Michelle, and I represent Edina and West Bloomington. Also have a piece of the Hopkins School District, and I also want to thank those who have helped put this together, especially our staffs. Who've had to deal with multiple calendars. And I'm excited about trying to grow a little momentum for an issue that I'm going to guess that most of us all believe in. But particularly going into a legislative session, we need to get our ducks in a row by February. It's going to be a short session. There's something called a campaign going on next year, so there's going to be a lot of distractions and some noise, and I'm really hoping that you can help us raise this early childhood issue above some of that noise. So thanks again. When I was 3 years old, I was in a suburb of called Bryn Mawr, a suburb of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Oh, interesting. Thanks. I want to make sure we thank staff, too, and that was a good one. I want to make sure Sarah Bensculter can raise her hand as committee administrator for the House. Here, and she's done a lot of work on this for this committee and setting up. Matthew Colley, who's right here, is our new committee legislative assistant, so a new face on the committee and has been doing a tremendous job. And over in the Senate, we have Gretchen, who's right here, who is, Gretchen, your last name, remind me?
Tucson.
Oh, you know that, Tucson. Who works with Senator Wieger, has done a lot of work on this, and the new LA for Senator Wieger, Lindsay?
Jen.
Well, close. So thank you all for your work, because they really did pull this together, and we very much appreciate that. Why don't we start? Oh, and Lisa Venable, who's right here with United Way, who is working with the Early Childhood Caucus, has done a tremendous amount of work and worked with all the testifiers and their testimony and so forth. So we very much appreciate the partnership with United Way and all the work that you've done, too. So thank you very much. Why don't we start with Jen down here and then work this way?
Jen Olson, State Senator, District 33, which is Western Hennepin County, and I grew up and at three, age three, I lived in Brooklyn Center, amongst the potato fields, before the crowd changed to houses and kids. So not too far from here. These are kind of old stamping grounds in North Minneapolis.
Yeah. I'm Claire Robley, and I'm State Senator that represents Shakopee, Fire Lake, Savage, Jordan, and Newmarket, Elko, a very fast-growing area with lots of young families. And I am one of the co-chairs of the Early Childhood Legislative Caucus and have been since the inception of that group. And when I was 3 years old, I was one of seven children on a dairy farm in Chanhassen, which no longer has any dairy farms left, but it was a wonderful place to grow up.
My name is Lynn Wardlow. I'm from, I represent 38B, which is the eastern half of Eagan. And when I was 3 years old, I was in Sioux Rapids, Iowa, a town of 1,000 people down by Spencer. I started kindergarten a year later at 4. And I almost flunked first grade. I didn't catch up till the end of first grade. I went from the buzzard reading group to the bluebird reading group. I remember that, and I remember sitting in the corner in kindergarten.
Sandra Peterson, I represent Plymouth New Hope and Crystal Robinson School District. And I have deep roots in Minnesota. I grew up in Benson, Minnesota, which has been alluded to by the governor as a very progressive small town out by Wilmer in the western part of the state. And I grew up on land that was homesteaded by my great-great grandparents from Norway, and we still own the land. It's very special. And however, I couldn't wait to come to the big city and go to McAllister College and be in St. Paul, where I thought all the action was. And it was right. That's where it was. And I also have taught in early childhood, spent most of my years in the high school teaching, but did some years in early childhood. And I have to say that my experience one summer with preschool special ed, three-year-olds, four-year-olds who were special ed, emotionally disordered preschoolers was the hardest thing I've ever done in my teaching career, and decided that I did not have the patience, actually. I mean, that is just an infinite amount of skill and patience to deal with those young children, but so necessary. And so I've been an advocate, longtime advocate, of all of the early childhood programs.
I'm Carolyn Lane, and I represent Columbia Heights and part of Fridley and a little bit of St. Anthony Hilltop over Easter. And I grew up in Hibbing, Minnesota, up on the Iron Range, so I'm a ranger.
Once a ranger, always a ranger. My name is Patrick Garofalo. I represent Farmington, Lakeville, as well as portions of rural Dakota and Goodhue counties. When I was 3 years old, I was in St. Paul, down by the state fairgrounds, and I'm here to listen and learn.
And I'm Erin Murphy, and I represent a district in St. Paul that goes from the Mississippi River almost to the state capital. When I was three, I was living in a small town called Columbus, Wisconsin, surrounded by dairy farms and cornfields. And I went to the same kindergarten as did my mother, and it had a cool mosaic elephant on the floor.
Hi, I'm Chuck Weger, State Senator in North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale. I chair the Senate Education Committee. We're proud of the joint work that's being done here. Having grown up in North St. Paul at age three, we did not have early childhood programs, but when I ran for school board, at the encouragement of a college prof at age 21, I had a six-point platform, and one was to start an early childhood program. And I was elected at age 21. We implemented that program a year later, and I'm very proud of that accomplishment that a lot of people put together. Each of our five children went through that program, and our grandchildren are today.
Thank you. Well, thanks to all members. It's, you know, this is the time of the year where we're not supposed to be meeting as much. It seems like a very busy and full year. And as Senator Michelle said, it's time for us just to get our work done and try to come up with a plan before session starts. So with that, I'd like to invite the commissioner to come forward, Alice Segrin. I also want to thank those in the audience. If we had time, we would like to go around and see where you all were at 3 years old, but we're not going to have time today where you were living. But I want to thank you for your work. I know a lot of you work directly with kids and programs that serve young children, and I think the work you're doing is very important. And we are here, as Representative Garofalo said, to learn and to listen and try to do the right things for the young people in our state. Oh, Commissioner Segrin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Can you hear me all right?
Is it picking up? I think you have to get
it. Is that better? It says it's on. So.
There's no broadcast.
Oh, okay. Okay, so this is just for the tape?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Then should I put this back? I all right. I'll try to talk loud. I'm Commissioner Alice Segrin, and I was, at 3 years of age, I was in St. Louis, Missouri. And just a little anecdote, in St. Louis, Missouri, I discovered about 10 years ago that the first kindergarten was established in the whole country. And my uncle, who just passed away at the age of 90 last year, was one of the charter school members of that first kindergarten class that ever happened in the whole United States. So that's kind of a cool statistic that I did not know about until about 10 years ago when I went back for a high school reunion. And I was just in another meeting this morning. You were asking us where we went to high school. So if you want to know, I went to Cleveland High School. So we've had some fun reminiscence today thinking about where we grew up. I want to just go through, and you have a PowerPoint, a copy of a PowerPoint in your packet. that you can refer to. And Representative Slawick asked me to just kind of give you kind of a framework of what is going on in Minnesota right now in the area of childhood. So if you turn, first of all, I want to talk just a little bit about kind of what we're looking at the Department of Education as far as where we would like to go with early childhood. And the first thing that we, you know, really are very committed to is focusing on at-risk children and children in high-need schools. We really feel like if we have to prioritize our resources, that's one of the things that we really want to strongly focus on. We also want to make sure that whatever we do in our pre-K programs, that they are aligning with what is happening in our the rest of our K-12 system. So as we're looking at readiness indicators, we want to make sure that students are, you know, starting to have that alignment and understand, the teachers that are working with children are understanding what they need to be prepared for, because as you know, we're demanding more and more rigor all the time of our children, and so it's very important that there's an alignment. We also know that it's very, very important that we have effective, highly qualified teachers in all of our system, and so that's very important, and we're very focused on making sure that that happens also. If you have read anything by Dr. Marzano, he talks about the teacher effectiveness is the number two factor in raising student achievement, and that's second to the influence of the parents. And I'm really, really very proud of the fact that we have, you know, resources, in fact, probably first in the nation to create the early childhood types of programs that really are looking at parental support and skill building. And then in addition, according to research of Dr. Bill Sanders, teachers we also know who experience two consecutive years of, or no, children, not teachers, students who experience 2 years of an ineffective teacher never academically recover. So it is really key that we make sure. Well, and let me qualify that. The fact is, if a child is on a trajectory and they've had an effective teacher year after year, but if they have 2 years of ineffective, they never recover that trajectory afterward. So that's why it's so key that we make sure that we have effective teachers in the classroom.
Excuse me, Commissioner. I just want to ask a question. Can people hear the Commissioner? Is everybody okay? I
mean, we're okay.
We're debating a different seating arrangement as we figure some other of an angle or some other way.
I can certainly stand in the corner if that would be.
Well, how about I reserve that for another time?
Say something about your school experience.
I almost wanted to go over there. At least you'd be facing everybody.
Yeah, I would be glad to do that.
You know, why don't we try that?
We can move the computer there. We can get further away from some of us.
I
think sitting down is probably good. And then you can get that. And you all, and we may move you guys around too, if that would be better. Can you see okay?
Well, I can do it.
You're going to be farther away from half of us. I think you're better off in the middle. So you want to come over here?
Why don't I stand and just try to project for all of you?
Okay. Thank you. Wow. So we want to make a good experience for everyone, and as long as we can hear.
We have a number of programs in Minnesota. Of course, one of the most fundamental programs that we've had in all states have is Head Start. But unlike some states, we actually put state money into the program, too. There are many states that put additional money into Head Start. We are one of those states. We also have School Readiness, and that is a grant program where our schools have school readiness programs. They apply, and they have a process that they go through to receive money. We also have the federal Part C program, and that serves our special education students 0 to 3. That was a program when I was in the legislature that was a grant program, a voluntary program, and we had to make the decision whether we wanted to make that a permanent commitment in the state of Minnesota, and that is something that I carried in the legislature to make that a permanent process for our students. We also have early childhood screening, and thanks to the legislature, we worked on bringing that screening down to an earlier age. So now at age 3, our students can start to be screened, and that's very, very important to catch some of those even physical conditions that we may not catch hearing sight problems that may go undetected. I have a personal story. My little brother didn't get a bad vision problem detected until first grade, and we were astounded at the fact that he thought trees were just kind of all these blurry green. He didn't realize that they were individual. Now, he could see an individual leaf, but he didn't get that concept. That's how bad his eyes were. So he was struggling until he got glasses, and then he really blossomed. Early childhood family education, I mentioned that in my remarks earlier. What a wonderful problem that we have for parents. To be able to come bring their children and sit and learn about all the wonderful things that they can be doing as a parent to engage their children, not only in education, but in all the kinds of wonderful disciplinary things that we need to know as parents to keep our kids on track. Also, we have early childhood literacy programs, the Reading Corps and Wordsworth, wonderful, exciting programs where we're looking at indicators of success and then intervening with children to make sure that they are progressing. And then first grade preparedness was a program that was kind of a precursor to our all-day K program that we have for a number of years. In the infant and toddler intervention program, now this is the part of the federal program, we have infants and toddlers that are under the age of three that are identified according to certain criteria for early intervention services in the educational area. There are program components to it. One of them is Child Find. That's where we're really aggressively looking for children through many different venues to be referred to Part C. We have public awareness and outreach. So we do have ways that we are communicating with doctors, for example, hospitals. Those that are maybe in the first responder type of mode, where they are the first people that will really have an interaction with the child and family. We have coordination, evaluation, and assessment, an individual family service plan, an IFSP. That individual family service plan actually provides wraparound services for the child. So it's bringing in the people, not only the medical care, but also any kind of human service support that a child and a family might need. It's a complete wraparound process, and we've often talked about how, you know, once they're through that IFSP process and they move into the K-12 system, that the families have had a wonderful benefit of support that then is in place for them as they go through. Then also we have, and then just to give you the number, we have about 3,500 students. The children that are in this program. I hate to call them students because they're different from college. I don't think of them as students, but they are certainly being prepared and supported for their K-12 experience. Then, of course, as I mentioned, we have the Early Childhood Screening Program. That's a collaboration between the Department of Education, Health and Human Services, and we have a standardized screening process. And the recommendation for appropriate screening instruments for infants and toddlers is an ongoing process. Then, of course, we have one of my favorite programs, ECFE, which provides parental support and education to parents to teach them about child development and all of the different kinds of things that parents experience. We do emphasize programming for children birth to three. It has had an emphasis in former years of being more for 4 to 5 year olds, but I know when Representative Slawick came in, and I think we were already kind of pushing that envelope to keep it down. We thought it made sense to have babies with their parents. And we have approximately 50,000 infants and toddlers that participate in this program, and I think that's really astounding. And then, of course, we have Early Head Start. That's the community-based program for low-income pregnant women and families with infants and toddlers up to age three. Head Start and the Early Head Start provides comprehensive health, nutrition, early childhood education, parental involvement, social services, family literacy, self-sufficiency, all of those wraparound services that are also reflected if you go back to the Part C program. Same kind of services for our special ed students. And Head Start is very reflective of those same kinds of wraparound services. And we have federal and state funds that serve about 2,000 infants and toddlers and their families.
We also are trying to continually build strong foundations, and we have an annual Minnesota Birth Security Conference. It's going to be January 31st through February 2nd, so we'll plug that. It's going to be at the Duluth Conference Center, sponsored by the Department of Education, Health and Human Services, and the University of Minnesota. And the audience, of course, is the providers and others that that are engaged in early childhood education. And then one of the most exciting and fun things that we have been sharing, in fact, we did that at the State Fair this year, is we rolled out a website called Minnesota, or mnparentsknow.info. And we is going to be eventually a comprehensive website for children 0 all the way through high school, where parents can go and look at child development benchmarks, can look at getting help for specific developmental challenges, if you will. There's an interactive part of it where parents can talk to one another. The website is vetted so that the resources that we have on there are the very best resources that have research behind them. We don't want parents to go and get sucked into some kind of a link that may not be a solid link. But it's a wonderful resource, and we have, I think, back here, I'm going to give this really quick. I want to make sure every one of you get one of these and distribute them to, if you have families that that you serve and you'd like to pick these up. We have a lot of these. It talks about all of the different kinds of things that are on the website. It's a little keychain, but it's a really exciting website. There's little video clips that you can actually go to and watch. There was one about a dad who was sitting on a couch with a bunch of his buddies watching football, and the big guys, and they're really excited and cheering on their football team. And in a little playpen was one of the Bella's sons, and he started to kind of cry a little bit, and it was really fun to watch how all of these big old men started to look at that baby and go, "Oh, it's okay, honey," and it's all right. And what was it demonstrating? It was talking about the relationship that you have with a child, the way you talk and speak with a child, the gentleness and all of the kinds of things that happen as you interact with the child. But it was doing some role modeling too, about how to pay attention, how to interact with the child. So there are little video clips like that on the Parents Know website too, and we are planning on expanding it. We've got this 0 to 12 months, and we're rolling out in the next few months, I think up to 5, and then we're going to be going up through the grades. I wish I would have had that when I had, when my children were teenagers, because I just wanted to lock them in a closet for, about 3 years until they grew up. But wonderful tips and things that are going on. I also want to mention, and I think maybe you all know that, we also have a campaign going. Dr. David Walsh was at Parents Alliance Conference, I think. Yes, the Alliance for Student Achievement. We've got a campaign going with a number of organizations called, and he's got a wonderful book called Say Yes to No. And it's a book on parenting, but the premise is, how do you really set parameters and guidelines for children in a positive way? And it's okay to say no to your children, but he gives you tips on how to do that, how to guide and instruct your children to give them a positive environment in which they can live and not feel like they're living by rules, but that they're living because we care about what they're doing. And it's wonderful, and so we've got a really great campaign going on that. So just wanted to plug that book, too. That's a wonderful resource that we'll be talking about also in the future. And just to give you, you want to look at the other handouts that you've got in your packet. This is, I'm not going to read these to you. You can read this yourself. This is the appropriation for 08-09 for Head Start and all the other programs that we have in the state of Minnesota.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
All right, what we'll do is we're going to have some dialogue after each presenter, but we have to kind of keep moving, so about 5 minutes. Members, are there questions?
Okay.
Just briefly with
the commissioner at the table. Commissioner, can you describe in a minute the administration's proposal budget recommendation from this past session that was particular to early childhood? Can you kind of lay that on the table for us?
Senator Michelle and members. We had a proposal to create a scholarship program for students that would, and I can't remember now, you threw me off here. I think it was $4,000 for each child, and this would be going to those providers that met indicators of quality so that parents would have a menu of opportunities that they could select. We wanted to focus on early childhood indicators of readiness, school readiness, to prepare them for kindergarten. And that is in process, actually. That was passed this last year, last session, and we have, we're working with MELF and the Department of Human Services, and that should be rolled out here pretty shortly now.
Commissioner Segrin and Senator Michelle, we're hoping in the second hearing to actually have some testimony from the department on that and how the implementation is going. So, Senator Bonoff will chair the second hearing and Senator Michelle will chair the third hearing. So there'll be some equity here between the House and the Senate. But I think we're all eager to hear more about how that's going at the next hearing. Is Representative Peterson?
We have, at one point in time, we had the Department of Children, Family, and Learning, and then it was again divided into the Department of Education and Health and Human Services. How do you differentiate the difference in your services, and do you have a common vision? Is there a duplication of services? How closely are you working together? Do you have the same goals? I'm always concerned that one might be going in one direction and one the other, and do we need to do more to get those two groups to collaborate?
Actually, was it last year or the year before, there was a request for our agencies to give information to the legislature on the kinds of programs where we work together as a department of either health, human services, or education. And we had, I think, probably 3 or 4 or 5 pages of all of the different programs that we either work together, overlap, train together, present together. So we really try to coordinate the efforts as we, as much as we possibly can. Probably the difference that I would say between human services and education is in the child care area. They are really more into licensing, making sure that there's, if it's a license, and you guys get into that more than I do, number of bathrooms, how many square feet of a room, those kinds of things, clean environments. And what we are emphasizing, of course, is the educational component of whatever program that we're looking at. And we, of course, are looking at ECFE. Those are primarily our programs. We have Head Start. Our school readiness program, those are always much more about just an educational component. It's not so much about, buildings or licensing, those kinds of things. So human services gets into more of the licensure type of issues, for just so that you have safety for children, for people that are actually caring for kids, in a daycare kind of situation where we're more focused. But when we can't integrate that, and that's one of the things that we're doing now with the scholarship program, is trying to integrate and making sure that there's an educational component in those providers that have, maybe traditionally haven't done as much of that, and vice versa, trying to get that.
I think Representative Murphy, and then we'll have to move on. I think. Commissioner Segrin, I think as a teacher, the child and public policy for the university, and the students did an analysis of it was a legislation requiring a coordination report. We'll have to take it up at a different time, but we're concerned about how much collaboration and coordination there is, and the report and some things like that. And I think maybe for another, we should have some follow-up conversations during the interim about practical, easy ways, we hope that the departments can work together, because as you know, it can be a struggle, but from our viewpoint, it sure would make policies
Madam Chair, that after we did that, analysis, we were all astounded at how much we do together, that the collaboration and the work that we do together is pretty closely tied with just about everything we do. So we were amazed with that. You know, even we knew we did a lot of it, but when you started listing all of the things that overlap and work together, it was amazing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, one of the things that I've worked on a little bit in my work on the committee is parental involvement. Mm-hmm. And since we're talking about 0 to 3 today, I was wondering if you could share with us a little bit about how the department balances the need for outreach and screening with the important role of parental involvement, and how you make sure you're balancing and not eroding the role of the family as you implement the number of programs that are listed on the document.
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, that's a really good question. And I think everyone, any governmental agency should struggle with that mightily, because I'm a firm believer that citizens and parents and whatever kind of legislation we create should create a self-sufficient society, not a dependent society. So to the extent that we can support parents in their role but not be intrusive in it, that's where we need to always be looking at the balance in regard to that. So as a commissioner, I'm always asking that question.
And just to follow up then, Commissioner, do you feel that the department and its efforts has struck that correct balance?
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, I hope so. If there are concerns that we aren't doing a good enough job, then I certainly want to hear about it. One of the things that I just recently came across my desk, and I just read it a couple of nights ago, Hutchinson has a wonderful program that they've instituted called the PASS program, and I forget what the acronym is, but Youth Parents something. But it's a program where it really helps parents become an advocate for their child in the educational system, and teaches them, kind of the ropes about how to work with a school district. But it really gives them a strong opportunity to interact. And I really like the program. In fact, I asked some other staff to look into, what it would take to maybe disseminate that information more broadly. It was very practical. It was sort of a 9-week little training program for parents to say, here's how you can, and here's how we want you to be welcomed into school district. We don't want you to be an outside, we'll tell you what to do kind of situation. So we're constantly looking at, and under the federal guidelines, I think with title, I don't know if it's 3 or 4 or 2 or 1, but there is a parental involvement requirement that we do have to look at strategies to keep parents engaged with their children, and that can certainly take many, many ways of doing, but I certainly always want to balance that, and appreciate your support of that, too.
Senator Bonner has one last question, then we're going to introduce the couple of new members that came in and invite the next testifiers to come up.
Commissioner, I'm interested in the work that the department's doing with Part C, mm-hmm. and it says that we're serving 3,587 infants and toddlers, and I suspect that if we were to be meeting the need, it would be much greater than that. Do you have any sense of what that would be? We're meeting all the needs of the families who would qualify.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonner, the way the Part C program works, we do have to identify and find every eligible child. We have a review of our child finding process. I think it's every 2 or 3 years, and that's where we really need to get your special ed people in here to understand the process. But we feel like the 3,500 is representative of as many children as we possibly can find to be engaged in that. And if you think about it, you're for the 0 to 3 population, you are really, you know, identifying those children that have some identifiable cognitive or physical disabilities, or who have the potential of, and that's been an expansion under Part C that just recently happened, where we have to also look at parents, children of parents who need, have been in drug treatment, have been homeless. There are a number of other categories that have kind of expanded our child kind, our allowance of us to enroll those children as potentially in need of services. So we have, you know, we are trying to be very aggressive in our child find. And we, you know, according to the federal, they don't put quotas on things at the federal level for those things. But we're pretty much in the ballpark as far as the percentages. We're working a little bit more aggressively on the child find. And if you want more information about that, we can get that for you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your testimony. And I think we have some follow-up questions, but I'm sure you know where to find you. We'll be contacting you. So thank you for being here. I would like to invite the next testifiers to come forward. And in the meantime, we've had two members join us, Representative Wickler and Senator Salson. If you could introduce yourselves, your district, and where you lived when you were 3 years old.
My name is Ryan Wickler. I represent District 44B, which is parts of Golden Valley and St. Louis Park. When I was 3 years old, I lived in the woods outside of Bemidji. I mean, in a house.
I'm Kathy Salson, and I'm losing my voice today. When I was three, I lived in a very, very small town, Elwood, Illinois, outside of Joliet, Illinois. So, very small. I kind of forgot about that. And all I remember is that when we moved, when I was 4 years old, that we had to leave my swing set that I got on my third birthday. I will never forgive that feeling.
We have a couple of staff. I wanted to introduce themselves. Emily is out there. Emily's our fiscal staff. And Mike, right, who's research. And did I miss anybody?
In the back, we've got Toby.
Okay.
From education.
Want to raise your hand? Anne-Marie? Shelby? Yeah. Thank you all for being here, too, and for the work that you do down to Capitol.
Did Emily have her baby?
Oh, yeah. Emily did have her baby. There was a question about that. And
so very interested in early childhood.
We'll hear more about that soon. Good. Welcome to the committee.
Do you prefer that we stand as well?
Well, what is, you can do it from here. As long as,
okay.
You know, there's people maybe have enough here.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Maggie Diebel. I'm the Director of the Community and Family Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. We are here before you to speak about the Family Home Visiting Program. I just want to give a brief introduction to that. The Division of Community and Family Health houses several programs, the Maternal Child Health Program for the state, the WIC program, Minnesota Children with Special Health Needs, and the Office of Public Health Practice. While we're going to focus on family home visiting, I wanted to say as well that in our other programs, too, there is a large focus on the 0 to 3 infant children. For example, the WIC program in the state sees half of all the 70,000 infants born in the state. And I think it's just a tremendous opportunity for us to have an impact on the health outcomes of these kids in terms of providing them with the foundation for good nutrition throughout their lives, which really prepares them to succeed in life. So other things to be keeping in mind to prepare kids to be both physically and mentally able to take on the challenges of life. Similarly, the Minnesota Children with Special Health Needs Program, as the commissioner says, works closely with that age group to ensure that kids who are identified through a newborn screening program, and we work closely with the Minnesota State Laboratory to identify those kids, but then provide follow-along services to ensure that they are identified and linked in with the appropriate support services that they'll need throughout life. The Office of Public Health Practice serves to facilitate the working relationship between the state and local public health departments, so that's an important function that we serve as well. Our job in terms of family home visiting, which I will introduce Mary Jo Chippendale, who is the supervisor of the Family and Women's Health Unit in the Maternal and Child Health section. She oversees that program. Our job is to administer the state and federal funding that goes out to local public health to implement family home visiting programs. Our job is also to provide training and technical assistance support to our partners in that effort. So with that, we'll ask Mary Jo to provide an overview of the Family Home Visiting Program.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. On my way into work this morning, I have about a 40-mile drive. I was thinking about this presentation and thinking about the very first time I had a home visiting experience, which was way before I was involved in public health. I was living in Montana at the time with my husband. My family was all in Minnesota. They offered a home visit there to every new mom who delivered. I didn't have family support around that most families have, and the nurse came out to my home and met with me and my little daughter and left the house and told me when she was leaving, "You know, you're doing a really good job." I can't tell you how much that meant to me at that time, just having somebody else answer my questions and tell me what a good job I was doing. So I'm thrilled to be able to be here to share my passion regarding home visiting with you. And you do have in your packet a copy of the presentation that I'll go over a little bit. Public health home visiting. All families are determined to be at risk are visited in the home by a public health nurse or other paraprofessional who works together with those families with joint efforts to address specific needs and goals in a culturally appropriate manner. What makes public health home visiting unique is that it has a relationship-based foundation. It focuses on health promotion and prevention. And it is population-based, so it's looking at populations at risk or populations of interest, basically healthy populations that maybe could still benefit. And I think I was in that category when I was in Montana. It encompasses both physical, emotional, social, and environmental aspects of health. We know that research demonstrates that there is success with public health home visiting. It improves health and behavioral outcomes. It demonstrates fewer incidents of child maltreatment and out-of-home placement, less use of emergency health services, caregivers more gainfully employed, and children are more likely to enter college are just a few of those activities. What makes it a success? It has a family-focused intervention, it's culturally appropriate. There are effective linkages and referral networks. It's really an important piece of public health home visiting. And there are trained, experienced home visitors who receive ongoing, effective supervision. That's an instrumental piece of making sure to have that ongoing supervision. It also is strength-based. It comes at a strength-based approach rather than a problem-based approach. We know that a study by Washington State Institute for Public Policy demonstrated that for each dollar spent, the financial benefits to the government range from $2.24 to $2.88. In Minnesota, we have the Minnesota Home Visiting Statute, Family Home Visiting Statute, that looks at a family home visiting program that's designed to foster a healthy beginning for children, improve pregnancy outcomes, and that was something that was added in the last legislative session, promote school readiness, which has been another key focus recently added, preventing child abuse and neglect, reducing juvenile delinquency, promoting positive parenting resiliency in children, and promoting family health and economic self-sufficiency. Visits begin prenatally whenever possible. It's a key piece. We're talking children birth to three here, and that's a very important group, but it's important to even think about that group prenatally, so even before those children arrive. If we can assure a healthy birth outcome for those children, as well as prepare that family to be able to address those children's needs, we will be much better off and be a step ahead. We look at families that have a risk of homelessness, risk of long-term welfare dependence or family instability. Adolescent parents is certainly a key focus. Those with a history of alcohol or drug abuse, history of domestic abuse, other issues, reduced cognitive functioning, lack of knowledge of child growth and development,
little resiliency for adversities are some of the things. And I can tell you, in the course of years that I worked in the area of family home visiting at a local level before coming to the city, that we certainly saw an increase in those risk factors that we were working with there. Local public health home visiting must send a plan into the State Department of Health. That's a recent part of the legislation that happened in 2007. That plan needs to include outreach strategies that those local public health agencies are going to use to assure that those at-risk populations are aware of the services available to them and engage them. Looking at a provision of seamless delivery of services, so collaborating with their other partners in the community. I think somebody mentioned earlier how the Department of Health, Ed, and Human Services working together. This certainly should be happening at the local level as well as the state level. We hope we model that at the state level, and so that local agencies are also being able to do that. Looking at methods to promote continuity of services, we know that with many of the high-risk families that we serve, they're mobile. They move in and out of communities, and it's important that we offer a basic level of service and be able to assure that those families have a continuum of services, even when they move out of the community that they may originally have started out in. And we need to collaborate with multidisciplinary partners. One of the key pieces in the legislation that we have is that there needs to be an ongoing training component where we at the Department of Health provide technical assistance to local communities. We actually are working with a training work group that's going to look at how we can address the needs of home visitors in the state more collaboratively and holistically, that we're assuring that they have the foundation they need. And we know that we need to do that with all home visitors and their supervisors so that those home visitors are also getting the support that they need out in the communities. And you'll see in the presentation many of the items that are required in the legislation that we need to be training people on. How to build those relationships, how to engage families, how to address issues regarding child development. So it has many components to it. There are some outcome and performance measures that are outlined in the legislation. Rates of children's access to early educational services. How do we work together to assure that those families do get into ECFE, Head Start, and other programs that are available educational-wise. Program retention rates. We know that a lot of times it's that relationship-based foundation that is very important to the families. So are you engaging families on a long-term basis? Change doesn't happen in families overnight. Many families, you need to have a long-term relationship with them. So how do you retain those families? Number of home visits provided compared to the number planned, participant satisfaction, and rates of at-risk populations reached. In the last legislative session, we received increased TANF funding. In new in 2007, $4 million was allocated additional to the $3.579 million that we had previously. Most of that money went out to local public health agencies to work in their communities regarding home visiting. There was some funding that was given to the Department of Health for training and outcome evaluation. That's where our work groups are currently working at, is how do we demonstrate those pieces. The tribal governments also received some funding, and we're doing a parallel process and working collaboratively with them so that we're matching some of the things that we're doing regarding home visiting and maximizing the resources that we have available.
Good, thank you. We'll just take, we just have a minute or two for questions. We're running a little bit behind. I know this was interesting. I don't think I've heard this whole that detail before. Are there questions, members? Senator Roland?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering about referrals or how to get people into the program. Does the WIC program do that? Does the MFIP program do that? Do doctors and nurses do that? How do you reach out?
Ms. Chippendale.
Madam Chair and Senator Roland, all of those areas that you listed are ways that we do outreach for family home visiting. Certainly WIC, many communities, many public health agencies have WIC within their agency. So they certainly are utilizing that resource. And many smaller communities, actually, the public health agencies may also be doing WIC. So they can see families in a variety of ways. Doctors and nurses, also many communities, local public health agencies have worked with those folks in their communities to get those referrals. ECFE, I've seen work together with home visitors to do adolescent parenting types of activities. So there are many ways that we've outlined. It is hard sometimes to engage those families.
So it's not only doing the outreach and finding out about the families, but then how do you meet that family where they're at so you can engage them in the service?
How much resistance do you have from families who feel that it's intrusive? Are there families that feel that way, or are they pretty welcoming?
I, Madam Chair and Senator Bowman, in many cases the families are welcoming. Certainly there are some that are more anxious to have somebody visit them. One of the things that I think is beneficial with public health home visiting is that it's viewed in a different kind of context than social services a lot of times. And so I think you look at what that family's needs are and who they're accepting of. And a lot of times public health is seen as a non-threatening type of place. And so I think that smooths things over in many instances. But certainly on occasion there are families who are very anxious to have anybody enter into their lives.
Madam Chair and Senator, if I can add to that, I will say that oftentimes some of the families that we work with are very mobile, and they're moving from county to county. So I think, again, one of the challenges is how to provide, you know, continuity of services as these populations are moving around the state. So it certainly is a topic of discussion in terms of collaboration and setting a system so that the services that are provided are connecting, and those referrals that are made are effective referrals.
I just had a quick question. Do you coordinate your services at all with any of the health care plans, like the insurance plans?
Yes.
I mean, I'm serving on cost containment strategies and helping in the services. And it seems to me that there would be some incentives here for insurance companies and or the state to insure the children to provide these kinds of services or to coordinate.
And Chair Representative Peterson, yes, at the local level, many local public health agencies work collaboratively with those health plans. In some cases, the health plans actually make referrals when they become aware of a high-risk family that could benefit from services and get as much collaboration as is on the level.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for being here and for your testimony. Next we'll have Representative Lane is going to give some testimony. We did forget to introduce one legislator in the audience, Representative Mullery. Do you want to introduce yourself and let us know where you were living when you were 3 years old?
Actually, that's more than easy because I've lived in this community my whole life. I'm Bill Mullery, living in this district. And when I was 4, I have a picture. This is the McKinley neighborhood, and the McKinley school was right over there. Knocked down a few years before they rebuilt another school right a few blocks away. But when I was 4, I got a picture of me on the picket line with a picket sign that's bigger than me.
Oh, really?
Was one of the teachers.
Wow.
You started early.
Good, thank you. Next we have Representative Lane to testify. She, if you haven't heard her talk about it, she is getting her PhD, right?
It's on leave right now for doing this job.
Well,
I am 3 years into a PhD in psychology.
Psychology, and has done a lot of work in this area. And so I've asked her to shorten it a little bit, but she's going to talk to us about
thank you. One of our strategies we have in closing the achievement gap is to ensure proper development in the brain from 0 to 3. And what I'd like to do is talk about why that's important. If one child is working poor academically, then you're going to gear more academically into that child. But when you see a larger trend in society where it's happening over and over with a certain group of children, then you've got to look at why that's happening, what's the mechanism behind that, not just gear into trying to work harder academically with them, because the problem isn't then, it's before. So you have to find the underlying mechanism. It's a symptom of something deeper. And to me, I'm going to push very hard that that's the brain development happening prenatally all the way to 3, at least, but for sure right there. And we have serious things to look at that age level in what we do to support the brain development and what we do to impede it. If you have 2 years of poor schooling when you're older setting you back, can you imagine if you impede that early foundation 0 to 3, how you're going to set it back and, quote, never recover? We'll talk about that. And if WIC is seeing 1/2 of all the babies born in Minnesota, is that what you said? WIC is not necessarily for your average family that we usually think about in middle-class America. So I'm going to be examining or addressing an extreme on the scale of good child rearing. So I'm going to make a point by examining the extreme. Don't misread what I'm talking about. But there's remarkable advances in our understanding of the brain in the last few decades, so it's our opportunity to address it and understand it at this level, how we develop this biological foundation of what it means to become human, to be human as we become adults in a full way. So first of all, we'll look at some of the connections that we see between brain and the results we see in children, just some simple things. If there's a safe and nurturing environment as opposed to an anxiety-filled environment, think about that. There is, in the safe, nurturing environment, children tend to have an enlarged forebrain. That's where we have reflective, language, thinking, creativity, self-control, and a smaller hindbrain. That's where there's reactive, fight-flight, instinctual, knee-jerk reactions, and a somewhat smaller body compared to those in the anxiety-filled environment. I have seen some of this played out in the inner-city schools, where some of these middle school and high school boys, you would never guess their age. A 13-year-old looks like an 18-year-old. A 17-year-old looks like a 22-year-old. And it causes problems for them on the streets when the police think they're not a juvenile. And they have a reduced forebrain. That's where the academics lie. The larger hindbrain. I speak often of a fourth-grade boy walking down the hall, and somebody just brushes by him accidentally, and he's ready to fight. Instinctual reaction. Based on their life history. Another study parallels later puberty in the safe nurturing environment and earlier puberty in the anxiety-filled environment. Why? Well, in all living things, if survival is threatened, you move quickly to reproduce. That's how we get flowers forced in a greenhouse. You restrict the needs of that plant, and it blossoms. So what's a key determinant in a safe nurturing environment as compared to the anxiety-filled environment? It's the mother or primary caretaker's emotional state. She has to be, or he, emotionally available, responsive, and sensitive to the child's needs. This is key. And in the early days, it is the mother, but as it can be a primary caregiver as time goes on. There is a specific sequence in the brain development, and you see it manifested, obviously, in children's abilities. They can't talk until the language centers are developed. They can't remember as an adult does until the hippocampus, which develops around age 3, has long-term memory. So the early memory, my little grandson can remember all kinds of things, what he did last week, who so-and-so is, you know, colors, all these things. But that memory is taking place in the amygdala. He's not going to remember age 2 when he's 15 because he doesn't store it, and the hippocampus isn't there to store that memory. So that we're very, very dependent on how the brain develops. You can't do Piaget's concrete operations, which develop at 7, before that. You can't do numbers and classify things until it's in place. You can't do formal operations until around age 12, abstract thinking, hypotheticals, figuring things out, making logical analysis. And actually, there's some concern as to whether we are actually getting there as a society. There's some studies that say a third of the adults never get there. Okay. That part? But then our answer to some of these things is to work harder to force it, which means that we both impede the actual operations of the formal operations and neglect the foundations that we're supposed to be doing at that time. We're doing some of this, okay, I'm going to go back to this, by forcing early academics in young children. When we use actually abstract, simple systems that actually require a formal operation kind of thinking in a 6-year-old. They, you know, break down these sounds, figure it out, analyze what if situations. We believe that this is helping them get to that stage. We don't help them get there. We're there when they get there, and then we draw forth. That's what I call education, educo, leading forth. We don't make it happen. We ride on the back of the biology. This is a major point. And so when we don't do that, we end up impeding both the foundation and the end result. Definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. If we talk about the specific sequence, I'm going to speak of four brain systems. One of them is rather new. Each of these needs to be in place fully as the foundation for the next one. And the next one will incorporate the previous into it, lifting it up into slightly a new way of using it. And they all require modeling. It's not teaching. It's not putting on. It's modeling. Somebody's got to represent that and show that. And the sequence keeps going. No matter how much you get it in place along the way, it just keeps going. So the first one, sensory motor. It's basically the spinal cord and the brainstem. And it's called the hindbrain, the survival brain. It develops a big development in the first year of life. Outer sensory world, baby crawls in the belly, reacts to sensations, especially see, taste, and touch. Purpose is to develop the survival or maintenance instincts, go to food, get away from danger, the fight-flight thing. Provides for quick reactions, reflexive behaviors, how to mobilize the body. Later on, it actually allows for the development of the habitual pattern of functions of typing, riding a bike, driving, piano playing, and it frees us then to stand outside that scale and be creative in our use of it. Interesting aspect of this is also the ability to do what is necessary to adapt to circumstances, a sort of chameleon. It can provide for lying, for being deceptive, and for finding a way to rationalize that to make it right. I see this in at-risk children, too. It's fully developed around age 7, because at that point, the neurons, their axons, myelinate. They get a sheath over them that allows them not to be washed away in a neural wash. Every so often, the cells we're not using, we're done with that area, we got it covered, wash them away, no use pouring energy into them. And when they're myelinated, then they're not going to be exposed to that neural wash. And the other thing it does is allows the neurons to work faster because there's no interference. So when it myelinates, it's pretty well set. And it develops from the first year to about 7. There's a saying in one religion, give me a child until age 7 and I will have him forever. Well, you may intellectually reconsider things in that experience, but stress comes, back brain, for 7 years of life, boom, you reflexively move back to it. We really need to take care of what we put in there in those first 7 years as to how you're going to react to things. Second center, emotional cognitive center. It moves around the brainstem like a limb, so it's called the limbic system. It starts to develop in the second year of life, age 1, after the sensory motor system is more functional. The child now stands, walks, begins to relate to the world as objects, relate to those objects. He becomes aware of an interior subjective world, feelings about the outer world and one's relationship to it. Emotion is a general term we use for all the tools we use to qualitatively evaluate all relationships, things and people. So relating intelligently, learning, memory are all involved here. When all the motor brain centers are developed, this area will actually organize that which is below, sensory motor, where we take in the information, and that which is next, the neocortex, more thinking. It will organize them together and allow thinking, feeling, and acting to interact as one. It will provide for that focused attention and concentration that we need. Academics. It gets fully developed around age 11, and there is when it myelinates. I'm aware of a window of opportunity around age 11 to discuss alcohol and drugs with your child because they're old enough to begin to understand it intellectually, but they're still willing to listen because they haven't fully myelinated out of this area. So both of these brain systems, in fact, all of them require that emotional availability of the primary caretaker. Responsiveness and the sensitivity to needs. This is probably equally important for teachers throughout the lifetime. Third area is the verbal intellectual area. It's the large area of the brain that we think of when we think of the brain, the whole neocortex. It's 5 times greater in size than both of these combined. Its development begins around age 4, and we'll break that down in a minute. It has to do with language and thinking. Eventually, it gives us the ability to stand outside of the activities of our brain and observe them objectively. Why am I reacting? That inner thinking. Creative imagination, which is the actual foundation for all truly organized intelligence. It also gives us this what-if syndrome. Not, there's a tiger, I need to run, but what if there's a tiger? And so we can automatically go back into that survival brain in which we kind of put a hold on the larger thinking and use the intellect perhaps to rationalize our reaction rather than necessarily analyze it. One of my favorite quotes is Benjamin Franklin, "So convenient a thing it is to be a reasonable creature, since it enables one to find or make a reason for everything one has a mind to do."
So we're going to, Representative Lane, we're going to have to start to wrap up.
Okay.
So if you could.
Well, let's see. I wanted to mention the fourth area would be the prefrontal cortex. This is just emerging in the research, and it sits here behind the brows at the front of the cortex. And it grows in parallel to the other brain systems and will bring it all together into one civilized mind. Very experience-dependent. And it relates to some of the work that's being done on compassion and peacefulness here. And we'll never get to this if we don't predict other things ahead of it. I want to mention plasticity. So many people talk about the brain is very plastic. We can fix it later. Plasticity actually refers to the fact that we can continue to learn throughout our lives. We used to think we get to about 21 and that's the information we have. You can continue to learn. Well, when you are recovering from a stroke, that ability to have a plastic part of the brain where you develop those ability to walk, for instance, in another part of the brain is an extremely hard thing to do. One-on-one, time, effort. It's very hard. You take a child, for instance, from a Romanian orphanage who's been there for till age 7, who hasn't developed this, turns violent at age 8. The work that one particular family did all the way to age 15 to bring this child around was extraordinary. Huge amount of work for a long period of time to get to a point where actually it was the second growth spurt of the prefrontals, which they probably didn't know about. They kicked in at 15 and he realized, hey, it just dawned on me that they loved me. There was something else that came in there. But that was a huge amount of work. So I'm saying that we cannot redeem this problem in the school system. We're asking far too much. It does not belong there. It is not the place. And earlier academics is not the answer. The answer is attend to what is needed so that this thing develops properly and stop blaming the school system. Every system needs fine-tuning, but the school system will never solve the achievement gap for us. We need to address societal needs. So I say that the mechanism behind the achievement gap is this early brain development.
Thank you. Oh, I was wondering if you'd be willing to send us your testimony on email, because I'm not sure I understood it. I could think about it, because it's for some of us that aren't as technically trained. But thank you for your time. I could probably give us one question. Is it one question?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Salson.
Yes, Madam Chair. We talked in the achievement gap work group, is there an achievement gap or an opportunity gap? And how does this sense of, you know, are these children exposed to the right situations, modeling you're calling it, as opposed to academics? Can you briefly touch on that? I mean, what's the solution then?
I think the solution lies in things that we've just heard of regarding home visiting, really getting in there and developing relationships with the parents, with the mother early on, even pre-birth, and working in a long-term way to break the cycles.
Thank you. I think what we'll do is we'll move forward when Representative Lane is available by email, or and hopefully she'll send us a copy of her testimony so we can continue to look it over and digest it, because I think it's very important and I appreciate your time.
She's pretty wicked smart, isn't she?
Yes. Did you understand all that?
Formal.
Ask the people from Way to Grow to come forward. Elizabeth Fields, Sheena Green, you got the two. And then I know there's some other people here from Way to Grow. I know Carolyn Smallwood's here somewhere. Carolyn, do you have other staff here too?
Madam Chair.
Yes. Okay.
Madam Chair, just really quickly to wrap up on Representative Lane's comments. What she's saying is we may disagree about the solution, but her diagnosis of the problem is 100% correct. And just to provide a little more context in an adult setting for that, in college I was a law enforcement major, and they tell the story about how many times they would find police officers involving gun battles
who would die as a, they'd be in a gunfight and they would die, and they would find them with their shells in their pockets. So imagine if they're in the middle of a heated battle and the officer would take the time to put their shells into their hand for a revolver, put it in their pocket before they would reload. And the reason why is because when they're on the firing range training, they would yell at them not to leave the shells on the ground. So they'd practice shooting, they put their hand like this, put it in their hand, put it here before they'd reload. And then when you're in a high stress situation, what happens is you are literally incapable of thinking. There's no blood flow to your the cerebral cortex, right? And what happens is you just rely on your brain stem. You're literally not capable of thinking in those high stress situations. Just to reinforce in a more adult, practical fashion of what you're talking about. And I was not expecting that testimony. That was pretty cool. So I'm going to latch on to you here for a couple hours. Just suck your brain dry.
Thank you. Next, we'll start with Way to Grow. And
good morning. My name is Elizabeth Fields. I'm the Director of Early Childhood Development with Way to Grow. We are a Minneapolis-based organization that, through home visiting, works with families in a three-arm approach of family support services, health education, and parent-child education. And we do that through the work of our home visitors, our family educators, like Jean Green, who's going to testify in a few moments. Our current funders include the City of Minneapolis, Edmond County, Bush Foundation, McKnight Foundation, Minneapolis Public Schools, General Mills, Carlson Company, United Way, and many other funders. In 2006, we served 2,975 parents and children at an average cost of about $3,150 per child. Way to Grow really believes that sometimes two arms are just not enough to embrace the child and to help that child be successful in the early years and be ready to enter school. So we use a three-arm approach, that first arm being providing support services. Our family educators work closely with the families in their home, speaking their home language and sharing in their cultural beliefs to help them overcome economic and social barriers. This includes connecting them to organizations that meet basic needs such as housing, food, clothing, counseling, and employment services. These connections help parents create stability in their homes and foster an environment in which children can develop the skills and knowledge they need to be ready for kindergarten. The second arm of service revolves around health care. We believe that families need a basic level of health in order for their children to succeed. We provide education to families in their homes and in the broader community, including information about immunizations, prenatal care, well-child checkups, nutrition, and home safety. During home visits, family educators educate the families ages prenatal to 5, infant care, nutrition, mental health, social, and environmental health. We also believe that the development begins prenatally. We work with these families to ensure healthy birth outcomes. We provide classes to Native American, Somali, Hmong, Latino, and African American parents, pregnant moms, to learn about nutrition, labor and delivery, breastfeeding and postpartum care, attachment and bonding. All of these classes are provided in according to cultural norms for each group of people. The classes also help mothers to learn to navigate our medical healthcare systems so that they can succeed in delivering a healthy baby. We believe that once families are healthy and have a sense of stability in their homes, they're ready to embrace child development. Our family educators work with positive parenting and emergent literacy skills with the families in their homes, as well as in center-based programming. We coach parents on positive ways to interact with their children by creating routines, limits, consistency, high expectations, all through fun learning experiences, including singing, reading, talking, and playing together. Parents are taught dialogic reading skills to learn to have conversations with their children and increase vocabulary in children. Preschool PALS classes are offered for children ages 3 to 5. It's a traditional preschool class that meets 3 days a week.
for children. And we also offer Play, Learn, and Grow classes, which are parent-child classes, where parents are taught, coached, and encouraged in specific and appropriate, intentional ways to play with their children to foster vocabulary development, cognitive development, and social skill development. What do we need, you know, from you as a committee and as a government? I think one of the main things that I ask is for the state government, with your broad cultural influence, to help us change the public view from early childhood as a service that some families tap into, some children participate in, to more of a critical and integral part of every child's development. Everybody you talk to in Minnesota knows exactly what K-12 education is. Not as many, not nearly as many, understand what early childhood education is, and even fewer grasp the importance of first to three under that early childhood umbrella. Of course, your funding is integral as well. We ask that you join the current international, national, and local businesses and entrepreneurs that have already recognized the importance of early childhood in education and our funding programs, such as Way to Grow and other community-based programs. Many of the school-based programs are highly recognized and well-known in the community, and we ask that you begin to disseminate talks with your constituents and the general public about the community-based programs that are also out in Minneapolis and the surrounding areas across the state that are helping families to become advocates for their children. We're not here to take away the responsibilities from families, but rather give them the skills and the confidence that they need to take on that daunting responsibility themselves. And Sheena's going to talk to you a little bit about a parent and family educator perspective.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Well, my name is Sheena Green, and I'm a family educator at Way to Grow. I'm a single mom of five. I have two under the age of five. I was a participant at Way to Grow before I became an employee / family educator as of July 2007. I worked two jobs, and my first obligation was to take care of my family and their basic needs. Although I think education was important, it drifted because of my life circumstances. When I signed up for Way to Grow services, my family educator became my support, helping me to get back on track, focusing on my first and number one job, which is my children. My family educator became the person that helped me think of fun and creative ways of doing things in my daily life and teaching my children. My family educator allowed me to focus on the ABCs, 1, 2, 3s, the imagination of singing. If we keep our children's minds focused on positives of the world, it'd be less distracting than the negatives. While I was a participant with the Way to Grow, I had someone come into my home and believe in me enough to say, "You have a lot of skills and I think you should apply for a family educator." I procrastinated because I didn't decide, because I didn't believe in myself. So I didn't go right away. So I went to the interview. I came out on cloud nine. I have a mentality that I feel like I can uplift others, but it's hard for me to believe in my own self. So I was digesting, and I feel like this is my blessing. I was already discussing about the need to switch careers, and the opportunity came along and hit me in the face. When I was working at A Way to Grow, it was a blessing. As a family educator, I give back to the community by being a support system for families, because I know where a lot of families come from and how they feel. They welcome me into their homes, and I build a personal relationship with them. For our pregnant moms, we show them ways to bond with and teach their child from the womb. Our world is so corrupt that we forget the basic joys of becoming a parent. We show them how to deal with stress and still be able to teach and enjoy their children in everyday situations. We show them compassion and encouragement because it still takes a village to raise a child.
If we teach from the womb, the baby's mental state develops and absorbs more in the first 3 years of their life. By promoting ABCs, 1, 2, 3s, imagination, and encouragement at an early age, as a village, we don't just grow as individuals, but as a community, a city, and then a state. In this process, teaching our children education is important, and we start to follow the American dream, upholding the order of education, a career, then making a family, which the outcome can lead to less poverty. That is why I am committed in going the extra mile for our families so their children can become school ready.
Thank you. Thank you for being here and for sharing your story. I want to see if there's a little bit of dialogue. We have two testifiers left. We'll take a couple of minutes here. One thing I want to say, you know, parenting, for all of us that are parents or you know parents, it's the toughest job you'll ever love. And I think that people forget how tough it is for parents of newborns in particular and how isolating it is when they're out there and for anybody to say you're doing a good job, because it's, you never know if you're, what's happening and how to kind of gauge that. And I think this is such a tough area for us at the state, because the role of the state in early childhood education at this age is unclear. And that's part of what we're doing here, members, is the family, obviously are the first teachers, but what role does the state play in helping families to get ready and get their kids ready for school and better in life, and taking that message out. For any of you that are going to testify in the future, I guess I threw a little bit of a curveball at the end in asking the testifiers to try to relate to the legislators how we could help through a policy level or a funding level, because it's hard for us to take programs and then know what are we supposed to do with that information, whether it's just increased funding, because, you know, we can always do that if there's funding, but also for policies that will help us to do a better job as legislators. So it's very encouraging for me to see a program such as Way to Grow, I think, which helps at-risk families, you know, fill in the gaps of helping bring up kids and moving forward and helping families become self-sufficient. Are there questions from Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's not a question, but a comment for Ms. Green. Thank you for coming and sharing your life with us. And something you said struck me. You said there's so much corruption in the world. And there is corruption in the world. But I think the work that you're doing helps to mitigate that and keep the world on track, keep it working for the good. And each of us has a role in that, and you're playing it. And I wanted to let you know I appreciate it.
And Senator Roblin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Green, thank you, too, for your testimony. I know that you had some training as a participant in the Way to Grow program, and then when you were hired, did you get additional training before you started making home visits, or what kind of initiation into employment did you have?
I'm still in training. It's a six-month course, I guess, and for the first 2 months I was in training and videos and going to different groups and settings and being able to talk to the different people and understanding what they need.
If I could add a little bit to that Way to Grow training program, new staff come in, we have curriculum and training for family support services. We have three separate curriculums for the early literacy component that family educators are trained with, and a brand new health curriculum that's coming in as well that our director of community health trains. We do team home visiting to do coaching through those first home visits. And we also have about 12 hours of ongoing training per month for every family educator within Way to Grow, where we bring in new ideas but also keep revisiting the skills that we're working on with families each month.
Senator Rubin?
Just as a follow-up, when both of you mentioned that you were able to work with pregnant women, and how do you find them?
We, Representative Slavik and Senator Rowling, we do a lot of outreach. We do outreach through WIC. We do outreach through all the various people that you're hearing speak and testify today. We do word of mouth is actually our biggest biggest outreach with families that are saying to other families, hey, you're having a baby, I went through this great prenatal class with Later Girl, you should try that.
Senator Bono.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you both for your testimony. What do you think about the need out there? How do you feel like you are reaching the families that need your services? Is there many more that you're not able to get to? And can you just talk a little bit about how you identify these families?
Madam Chair, and Senator Bonner, we are not reaching there are so many families out there. That I think putting all of the organizations together that are testifying today, plus those that are not here, there will still be children out there that are not receiving the resources that they need. It is a huge, huge need. We do our best. And with Way to Grow, what we do, I think, different from other families, and the way that we reach families is through a very culturally specific practice. Minneapolis, Minnesota, the greater area, has a very large immigrant population. Our staff speaks seven different languages. And if you speak Somali, a family educator who is Somali and speaks Somali comes into your home to work with you. That is how we're reaching a specific population. I think if the tables were turned and I had a refugee to Somali with my son, and a very smart, kind, educated Somali woman came in to talk to me in Somali, and I want the best for my child, but that I cannot build a relationship with her. I do not speak her language. I do not know her culture. I need somebody who I can relate to, who I can actually talk with. And that's what Way to Grow provides to these families, to help them branch into the greater Minnesota culture.
This feels like a former student of mine. In early childhood public policy, it's very interesting to see how far you all have come as other students that are working in the department. So, wonderful, wonderful job. Any other questions? I think we're going to Senator Roblin.
And I appreciate that parents do need same language visitors, but how do you encourage them to help their children learn English, which is also somewhat critical for school readiness?
Madam Chair and Senator Rowling, it is critical, absolutely. What research tells us is that if we teach families to be teaching their children in their home language first, they start to see their child learn and progress, and that gets parents excited. And that's what we need to do first, to get parents really excited about their children's learning. And then we start to introduce the English, because they do need English to be successful, absolutely. So we start then a bilingual approach with these children, starting with vocabulary, giving them vocabulary. We often teach their parents just as much English as we're teaching the children along the way. But it's critical first that we support those families in their home language so that they can see the growth in their child and get excited about continuing that process.
So do the home visitors do some English language instruction? Like with the vocabulary words, right, with the parents and the child?
Yes, please.
Representative. And Senator Roebling, we absolutely teach, our goal is to teach the parents how to teach their child so that when we are not there, which is the majority of the month, and that parent is there, they're continuing that process. So yes, we're absolutely teaching the parent. Let's say we're looking at a book about colors that's in Spanish, and the parent gets very good at reading, having a dialogue with that child in Spanish, with that Spanish book. We start introducing the English colors, too, for that vocabulary. Teach mom that azul is blue. Make sure she understands that, can pronounce it, can write it, and then she can turn around and teach that to her child.
Good. Well, thank you. And we'll have more time for conversation a little bit afterwards. So thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And thank you for your work. Next, we have two left. We have Baby Space. If the Baby Space folks can come forward. Oh, you're not all coming together. And then we have Alice Dillon. I want to make sure we get to by about 10 till, I'm hoping. So from PICA Head Start. So think Dr. Rose is going to start?
Sure. I'd be happy to start. Thank you very much. I'm very thrilled to be here with you. And I have to tell you, knowing, having testified before, flexibility and timeliness, two important things not only in my job but in your job. And I'm going to allow Kim Aguilar to talk about our expansion of our baby space program. I really have two jobs. One, I've been able to take everything we know based on research and put it in a center in the Liberal Arts Community of South Minneapolis, a 0-3 program that is now being replicated in this site up on the Writers Reservation. We really know what to do, and we know how to do integrated services for very high-risk families. The second opportunity that I have at Baby Spaces, we're actually looking at the achievement gap, and particularly for American Indian kids, and working with Minneapolis Public Schools to create a pre-K through third grade program to really help be sure these kids are on track. The other great thing that I really get to do is to facilitate adult learning opportunities. And you have been in my mind for the last 2 weeks. What is it that I can do that can really help us move forward? Because that's the ultimate question. Last year you had bipartisan support around early childhood, but yet we couldn't move forward. And so that was the question that kept going around and around for me. So the two things I'd like to do is one, to present the sound bite. That is, can we all get around the same message? And the second one is to talk specifically about how, what I thought as I reflected on this was getting in our way. So the first one is the sound bites. What do we hope for every child under the age of 3 to be able to form relationships, experience and regulate their emotions, and learn and play in their environment? Those are the 3 things that set that foundation that is going to allow for school learning, for development of peer relationships, for being competent citizens. And that foundation, we actually know what leads to that success. Responsive, consistent caregiving, reliable, predictable care by others. It really has to do with that earliest relationship. And you have heard programs this morning, and we'll hear other programs, Early Head Start, Nurse Home Visiting, Baby Space, all kinds of programs that help the parents build that foundation for their children and be responsive. At Baby Space, we even look at having child care as a partner in that we can create babies that are better at giving cues and signals, which then makes parenting easier. So those are the 3 things. We know what to do. We really know what to do, and we have great model programs for doing that. We even know what gets in the way. Aberrant caregiving, parents that are not able to be responsive, consistent, and reliable, and severe economic hardship. We have really good data that shows that those two combinations for very, very young children, infants and toddlers, results in kids that get off track long term. And why do we care about kids that get off track long term? Because they stay off track. Then they're downstream, and we're working in special ed, the juvenile justice system. We're even creating barges in the middle of the river because we can't even get these children onto shore in terms of typical development. So if we start early on where they're within arm's reach and we help support the family and within, the child within the context of the family and community, we can really keep kids from needing those later, very expensive interventions. So the sound bite. The second piece is, I realized as I was thinking about this, I was doing a sociology project with my daughter, who's in 11th grade, and we were talking about the change in the United States between being a collective community to being an individualistic community. And even asking her, well, she's like, well, my feelings are the most important thing I look at first. I created this child. Yes, because we pour everything into parenting these children, we let them believe that they're fearless. But where does that sense of community then reside? And I realized that that's actually where we are. That is, 6 years ago, we made this decision that as a community, we were no longer going to support the financial well-being of families in poverty. I mean, we had welfare reform. We felt that people needed to be responsible for their own well-being. And actually, in many cases, there's been lots of success with that. But where we're ambivalent is what to do about the children. That is, you take communities like the Reggio community in Italy, in which they say, young children are a community's priority, and we pour our resources into that. We take communities like Germany, who says 3 years of parental leave, because it's the most important that parents are with their young children. But we're stuck. We're stuck in that place that says, are we collectively going to be responsible for our very youngest members, or is it parental responsibility?
and we're stuck there. And I think we have to solve that issue. And I would ask you to do three things in order to look at that issue. One is visit a child care center. Your best child care center in your community. Work through their finances. Look what it takes to run the kind of program that we need so that you really get that hands-on experience with what the dollars mean as they perceive it. Number two is look at the experience from the baby's point of view. What is it like to be in a baby in a 4-to-1 ratio in which there are no adults are only diapering you and feeding you? What is it like to be with a parent who has a significant mental illness and you spend 9 hours a day in a foster? What does it look like from the baby's point of view? And then let's make our collective decision about how we want to care for our youngest members. And then really look at this issue of, can we get the soundbite that says, why invest early? Can we all come together with the soundbite that says, we need to do this because we know it has long-range consequences, and we can accept that collective responsibility. So with that, I will turn it to the service opportunities from these types of opportunities.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
I'm Kim Aguilar. I'm the program director at Northside Child Development Center, which is a strong beginning site in North Minneapolis. A strong beginning site means that we have a contract with Hennepin County to do additional services, smaller ratios, more teachers, screening and resources, referrals to families in lieu of a higher meeting.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear. You have to speak up a little louder.
Okay.
In lieu of what? I didn't hear that.
In lieu of a higher reimbursement rate from Hampton County. And the additional services then is Children's Services Manager. So all the children are screened at a regular interval. And then we also have a Family Service Manager. So there is home visiting. There's a relationship being built on an ongoing timeline. Also, with this relationship, we have the baby's face, which we shall talk about.
And that was taking the model developed by Dr. Rose and Dr. Deinert at Little Earth and integrating it into existing child care centers, three other strong beginning centers. So we knew that they were already high quality. And what we did was provide funding through grants, Bush, McKnight, and Harris, to hire a family facilitator whose job it is specifically to work with the families of children in infant and toddler classrooms to develop relationships and keeping in mind that these are all at Northside, 100% of your children are there because of received child care subsidy. And in all strong beginning centers, it's a minimum of 65%. So we're dealing with families who are living in poverty. And then what we've also done is provide infant mental health consultation services to support the teachers and the staff who are working with the children and the families and the parents. An example would be one day walking into an infant room, and the teachers are very exasperated because they had an 8-month-old who had suddenly become very fussy, would not let them put him down. They were upset that it was interfering with their ability to care for the other children. And by asking the family facilitator, the parent, to join us in trying to understand what was going on with this child, the mother said she was very worried about her child and she thought he was depressed. And when we questioned her, she admitted that she and the child's father had had a domestic incident the weekend before, and the child was being held by one of the parents during this time. And by sort of having the opportunity to encourage her about her interest in helping her child, the family facilitator was able to partner with her to get the domestic abuse services she needed. At the same time, we could strategize with the teachers and say, okay, who can you guys take this teacher's primary care group and spend more time with them so she can really give this child the holding and attention he needs now that we understand why he's being so needy. And within 2 weeks, that child was completely back to equilibrium. But without that kind of infant mental health support for the teachers to understand what the implications of the behavior were, you would have lost a real important opportunity, and also with the child. I think there's a paradox in child care because we think about child care as superseding the parent role, or at best supplementing the parent role, because we're taking children from chaotic, unstable environments, families who face multiple challenges, And we're putting this child and giving them 8 hours of stable, predictable, nurturing care and alternative kinds of relationships. But that's only a piece of what the potential for child care is. Because at the same time, based on this model, we're very intentionally developing relationships with these parents, because we know that research tells us that the most important indicator of children's success is the relationship with the parent. And so by also working with the parent and working with the child together in the setting, child care, if it's geared in this way, has the opportunity to really support the parent through giving the parent what might be the first experience with a stable, predictable relationship themselves. At the same time, we're also interested in trying to address parents' other needs, because child care is an incredible port of entry for parents into other kinds of services, because it's a normalizing setting. They're not there because we've identified them as having a problem. But child care as a community, particularly as a partnership situation, where we've got Hennepin County, Catholic Charities, Northside Child Development Center, the expertise from the university, that kind of partnership can create a much more comprehensive model, so that child care becomes actually a way to supplement and support parenting itself in really important ways, and not just provide an alternative experience for the children. And that harkens back to everything Representative Lane had to say about brain development, and what the research shows, that it's those relationships in the first 3 years of life that are so critical.
And just a quick say before we wrap up, because of all of this, parents really, really work hard at maintaining their authorization and their substance to continue to have their child go to these centers. And child retention rates are very high at these centers who have this good relationship with their parents. And the last thing I have to say is, with relationship with Hennepin County, we track our child's beginning kindergarten assessment. So a child that goes to our center for a certain amount of time goes against other children in Minneapolis Public Schools. And last year, our children were a success. 86% passed the beginning kindergarten assessment, where in all of the other Minneapolis surrounding areas, it was 56%. So just to summarize, it's good quality, consistent care that the children will be a success starting at the beginning at 6 weeks old.
Thank you.
And we have provided you with a very persuasive handout on infant mental health and child care, the potential for that, with specific recommendations about what you can do to try to implement those kind of support services in child care in the state. It's blue. And the goldenrod is a very helpful list of resources, online and printed resources that have to do with public policy, child care, and infant mental health. And I'd like to particularly point out the National Center for Children in Poverty and the 0 to 3 online resources for you.
Just briefly, one question. So are you actually talking about, not baby space so much that you're talking about, but you're talking about the early, what exactly, the name of the program you're talking about?
Strong Beginning. Yes. Strong Beginning is, and there are other child care centers that are Strong Beginning.
So Baby Space was integrated into four Strong Beginning centers specifically to promote attention and care for the 0 to 3, or the infants and toddlers and their families, and to make it much more relationship based.
How do people get into the Strong Beginnings program? How do they qualify?
It's just authorization, child care subsidies, their NSF plan.
So they're either coming from MSIP or basic sliding fee scale. And so the centers that are designated Strong Beginnings have to serve a minimum of 65%. And in Northside's case, it's 100% subsidized families, which is what makes their statistics all the more powerful. That, and you were saying your families, of the 75 families, the average income of families at Northside is $16,000. That is about 50% below the federal poverty guideline, and yet 86% of those children are coming into kindergarten at or above expectation for beginning kindergarten.
Thank you.
Senator Wilburn.
Now, you mentioned that the average family income was $16,000. If they were to pay for the child care in your facility, what would the average cost be per year?
It all depends on the age of their child. An infant is around $88 a day.
A day.
What would that translate into a year?
Well, there's also another handout you've been provided with. It's the Minnesota State Report Card from the National Center for Children in Poverty that shows that if we do have, relative to many other states, a rather high, we expect parents to pay a rather high proportion of their income for child care compared to many other states. So if we could reduce that, I think that would be very helpful.
Our committee, at least in the House, heard testimony from a YWCA, it was about $14,000 a year, basically, to take a child through the program. And so in our minds, we have sort of certain figures and tell us it's a $4,000 that we kind of look for. So we think it's going to kind of look comparison. So maybe if you can get back to us or send an email back with the rates for the different ages, and that would be helpful. We can get like extra numbers. Well, we'll go ahead to our last testimony, Alice Dillon. Members, a couple things. Let us know your feedback on this session. We're trying to, this is new for us doing these parent hearings, but things you'd like to hear about for 3 to 4 year olds and for the school partnerships. I think we probably all wanted, could have benefited from water. I don't know if you all, but it's hot here, so we'll try to have water this time. Turn in your reimbursement forms before you go. Remember, November 13th is the next one. Remember, you can be there, and it's in Senator Monas District, and we're not here at the community center. And Owen from Peterson District, too. And again, thank you for being here today. Okay. Thank you. Well, welcome to the committee. I'm not sure who's going to start.
I'm good afternoon, committee members, Representative Baldwin, Senator Bonas, Senator Michelle. My name is Alice Dillon, and I'm the Executive Director of Parents of Community Action. Parents of Community Action is a private nonprofit corporation that commonly known as PICA, that operates Head Start and other early childhood and family development programs for children and homeless families in Hennepin County. The majority of you on this committee I founded to learn today have constituent families that we serve in our program. It's quite amazing. So I hope that all of you will come out and I will be calling you to come visit us. Today, I'm going to have, rather than speak myself, several members of the PICA staff who have expertise in various areas. What we tried to do was tell you a little bit about who we are, some of the successes and things that we think are key components to a strong program for children from 0 to 3, and also a brief suggestion to the committee, although we have many here on, and we'd love to talk to all of you definitely.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rico Alexander. I'm the Director of Operations for Parents of Community Action. Parents of Community Action, we've been providing services to low-income children and families in Hennepin County for over 40 years. We serve 2,200 children currently, and we have 10 locations located throughout all of Hennepin County. To be eligible for Head Start, you must be at or below the federal poverty guidelines, which is a more stringent requirement than other programs that tend to use free and reduced lunch as a benchmark for eligibility. Head Start children are at 100% of the federal poverty guidelines compared to children who are on free and reduced lunch, and who are at 130% and 185% respectively. So a family of three who makes $28,000 is not eligible for Head Start, but that same family will be eligible for free and reduced lunch. We serve the poorest children at PICA. That includes a large population of homeless children. I know many of you are aware that homelessness among our young children and families is an ever-growing problem in our community. Last year, we served 438 homeless children and their families, and since our program year started in July, we have served 153. This includes infants, toddlers, and preschoolers. Many people are not aware that Pike was one of the first in the state to have a high-quality center-based program for pregnant mothers, infants, and toddlers. And we've been doing that since 1989. And so you have a better understanding of the population that we serve. As I mentioned, many of our families are homeless. We are racially and ethnically diverse, with 50% of our families being African-American, 26% Hispanic and Latino, 10% African, and 6% Hmong. Many of our families are from single-parent households. The primary languages spoken outside of English are Spanish, Oromo, Somalia, and Hmong. Services are provided in the area of parent involvement at all levels, including volunteerism in the classroom, to various trainings, including the governing structure, which includes the shared decision-making process with the board of directors, and health. In health, we see to it that all of our children receive complete up-to-date physicals and immunizations, as well as oral health and mental health assessments. Because we all know that children in poverty are at a greater risk and tend to have more health and physical issues than other children do. You can have the best early childhood curriculum, but unless you do some of these other things, we're going to continue to have a difficult time making real progress. The population we serve and the children that we serve, without early intervention and quality educational development opportunities, will be a part of the ever-growing, ongoing achievement gap we are trying to eliminate. Head Start has been able to create a strong model for closing this gap for many years. My colleague Candy Mullen, next to me, will share three critical elements to the 03 program that we provide.
Chairperson Flowers, members of the committee, my name is Candy Mullen, and I'm the Director of Education for Parents and Community Action Head Start. I'm here to tell you three critical elements necessary in 0-3 programs like ours in providing a solid foundation for all children. First, when thinking about our youngest population, we must consider relationships. There are three very important relationships that are key to future educational success. Relationships between the child and the parent, relationships between the child and the primary caregiver or teacher, relationships between the caregiver and the parent. Programs like Head Start foster and support these relationships through parent involvement opportunities. This includes ongoing communication between the teacher and the parent regarding the child's skills, interests, and goals that have been accomplished, the child's ongoing health needs, and parent support that may be needed. Dr. Robert Pianca of the University of Virginia has demonstrated through his research that relationships are key to educational success. It is these basic relationships that form the foundation for children's ability to learn. Relationships in the early years are particularly important and can often predict the type of teacher-child relationships in elementary school and beyond. However, there is one critical element to fostering strong relationships, and that is consistent care. It is extremely important that children, especially our youngest children, have consistent care. If they haven't had consistent care, it is not due to irresponsible parenting. It is often due to inconsistent funding for child care and or lack of affordable housing, which forces parents to move. For every move a family makes, the child loses the equivalent of 6 months of learning. In Minneapolis, a family typically moves 3 times per year. Imagine how this affects the child's learning. Now I want to share with you the second critical element, and that is comprehensive programming. Historically, Head Start has been built on the notion that a child cannot learn if their teeth hurt. A child cannot learn if they are hungry. A child cannot learn if they're not healthy. Comprehensive programming is the element that children living in poverty have to have in order to begin to even come close educationally to their peers who are middle to high income. It is the responsibility of all people to see that these children are given the necessary comprehensive services that will provide a solid foundation for learning. The last but equally important critical element is early intervention. Head Start children are the most vulnerable children who have the greatest gains to make and the most obstacles to overcome. If a family is lucky enough to have funding for child care for their infant, that child could potentially have 5 years of strong relationships, 5 years of learning, and 5 years of solid, comprehensive services. This child who is lucky enough to have this will be the child who is at the top of the learning on the achievement gap scale compared to his or her peers who may not have been eligible for child care funding as an infant and may have been on Head Start's waiting list for a year, only receiving 1 year of early intervention. We must provide full access for low-income children at the earliest age who are truly going to impact the achievement gap that exists right now and will exist into the future if this is not done. The last piece of information I want to share with you is a story about a child who I had when I was a teacher at PICA in our homeless program. Bruce arrived in my classroom when he was 4 months old. I knew right away something wasn't quite right with him. Knowing that he was homeless and could move at any point, I immediately started accessing our resources to see what kind of support he and his mother needed. He was screened, evaluated, and determined eligible for special education services. But before we could get the services started, he was gone. Fortunately, he returned a few months later, and we immediately went into action to continue what we had started. He started receiving services and eventually got into permanent housing and enrolled in our regular Head Start program. He graduated from our program and made tremendous gains because of our program and the early intervention he received, and later went on to elementary school with a solid foundation for learning.
You know, you're gonna have to wrap it up for us here. I'm sorry
we ran a little bit over.
And also, I want people to know that the Early Childhood Caucus, which several of the co-chairs are here, the members are going to continue this discussion through the caucus and through meetings we will also be having. So with that, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Representative Flowers.
Bana.
And committee members. My name is Aubrey Puckett. I'm the current Community Relations Director. Now that you've heard from my other colleagues, I would like to close by saying that it's very important that we begin to invest more dollars in direct services to children as soon as possible. With the limited number of state dollars available, our suggestion is to utilize it in more constructive ways. For example, the state is spending millions of dollars on ways to determine program quality. But we already have a great many tools that measure program quality. There is the NAYC and the Head Start program performance standards, and more. There are a number of tools at our disposal to ascertain what constitutes a quality program. It's not necessary to invest more money on task forces and initiatives. Quality has already been determined by experts across the country. Just look at the tools out there and make a decision on one or a combined tool, and then apply it uniformly across all early childhood programs, whether it be Head Start, school-based, home-based, because quality is quality is quality. And next, it's not helping to put the state dollars into little pots of money, breaking it up and sending it to different places that provide various grant proposals to programs, which is not enough money to make a real difference in the program. What the state needs to do is shore up Head Start and other quality child care programs so they have adequate operating money and there is an economy of scale in the funding that will allow them to serve additional children and build their programs. Thank you.
Good comments. And in closing, I'll just say along those lines, we are looking at putting funding streams together. And none of us can be happy about that either, but good suggestions. And we do need to hear your feedback. If there's things you think we can do better, we'd like to do them better. And you know the system much better than we do. Members, thank you again for coming. I hope you're able to join us on November 13th. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.